You're listening to the Warrior Priest Podcast.
And this is the Warrior Priest Podcast, midweek debrief number 188. And I am the Warrior Priest, Donovan Riley. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Thank you, as always, for your time and your attention today. I truly appreciate it. A special thank you and greetings to the 1,008 followers and subscribers of the podcast on Spotify. Shout out and gratitude to all of you who subscribe to the podcast on the other platforms. I truly appreciate it. I do. Today on the show, I want to zero in on exhaustion, actually. Let's talk about exhaustion. It is that time of year that we are coming out of the long season, out of Lent, and spring is impinging upon us now. You can smell it. Flowers are starting to push up through the ground. The grass is starting to green in places. Birds are out earlier. The sun rises earlier. And yet, for myself anyways, and perhaps for you then, it is also a time of anxiousness, of anticipation. We start thinking about our gardens, about spring and summer trips and vacations. It is a time of potentiality, of possibility, a time for us to shake off the slumber of winter. And I think then we have to remember, though, that it is easy to exhaust ourselves in the midst of our preparation and planning. One of the things that has happened for me this year in particular, then, is the constant push and pull of ministry, of leadership expectations, family responsibilities. And especially at this time of year, as I noted in class yesterday, in the late fall, in the season of Advent, and then in Lent during the long season, at least around myself, people tend to start losing their minds. They become more rigid, more lackadaisical and lethargic, which I think is a product of the winter. The longer the winter, the more we are motivated to stay inside, sleep in, take a break from things that normally we wouldn't even think about taking a break from. And the exhaustion then can creep up on us, unannounced, unawares. And I think it is important that we not overextend ourselves and overdo it or build up our expectations needlessly, but rather stay centered and focused on what is right in front of us today. What are we given to do right now? Yes, there are expectations. Yes, there are schedules to keep. People expect you to show up for them. The job is waiting for you. Family and friends are there. And so I'm not advocating that we become selfish and self-serving with our time, but rather that we become conscious and more mindful of time. Because as I've explained in previous episodes, time can lengthen or shorten depending on our focus on it. The more we look at our watch, the more we focus on the calendar, the days, the weeks, the months, the years, the faster time speeds by, which increases our anxiety because there is so much to be done, so many things that need yet to be accomplished. Where will we fit them in? How will we get them all done? Yesterday was particularly taxing for me, both mentally and physically, and emotionally, actually. There was a lot of responsibility heaped on me yesterday, and expectations were high, and I strive to meet those expectations. I hold myself to a certain standard of performance, So by the time the day was done at 8:30 last night, it took me 4 hours to calm down and be relaxed enough to go to bed. So I get to bed around midnight. The dog gets me up at 5:30 this morning. And I say to myself, I'll put the dog out. I'll go back to bed. When she whines to come inside, my wife will let her in. I'll get an extra hour to maybe even 3 hours of sleep. But instead, my brain said, well, since we're up, we should write that wedding sermon that you have to give on Saturday. So that's exactly what ended up happening. I wrote a wedding sermon at 5:30 in the morning. And then I thought, I'll just sit here and play some video games until my wife gets home from her errands, and then we'll all go to see Dune 2 in the theater in IMAX, because, of course, you have to see Dune 2 in IMAX. But then I realized, wait, if I do that, and it is a 3-hour movie, by the time I get home, it'll be time to go to the gym and teach. So when will I record the podcast? When will I prepare for Saturday and Sunday? I have a wedding Saturday. I have to teach classes Saturday. I have church on Sunday and classes after that. And then other people want me to go and attend meetings in between these things. Expectations can leech us of our energy and our attention. They can wage war against us in some instances where our allies, without realizing it, are bleeding us of our energy. They don't intend to, of course. They value our company. They want our attention and our time and our energy. And we, of course, as friends, as people we love, tend to give it to them regardless of our condition. And yet, as a sidebar then, how often do we say to someone, I forgive you, but they don't ever seem to have those words available for us? How often do we say, I love you, to someone who says, I appreciate you, or I really like you too? How often do we pour ourselves out for others, and yet we are interacting with people that do not pour themselves out for us? When we provide care, compassion, kindness, a helping hand for others, do those same people extend the same grace towards us? And if not, how are we to judge them? In some instances, we should judge them harshly. We should recognize this person is exploiting my compassion, which leads to my exhaustion. Compassion fatigue, in my experience, is very real. On the other hand, there are those who do not realize that they are taking advantage of your compassion, that they themselves are incapable, for whatever reason, of forgiving, at least forgiving as quickly and honestly and soberly as you, that they don't realize how important it is to tell another person, I love you too. If it's genuine and honest, why not say it? And if you do not feel that same love, then just express that. Be honest. You find me lovable. I find you very likable. And that's okay. Then at least we know that this is not a person that is going to reciprocate our love, our compassion, to the level that we are offering it, giving it. But we have to differentiate. We have to judge between those who are taking advantage of us maliciously, maybe even ignorantly, but in a destructive and harmful way, versus those who just don't have it in them to reciprocate. Otherwise, that exhaustion, it gains a certain gravity. There's a certain pull to it, which can lead to hopelessness and despair and feelings of neglect, being unappreciated, disrespected even, disregarded. And I find at least when I am tired and exhausted, when I am sick and struggling. That is exactly, excuse me, it's allergy season, so here we go. At least for myself, I find that when I am run down, sick, struggling, when I am exhausted, I turn in on myself and I start to judge people and judge interactions almost entirely in a negative sense. And it makes me bitter, resentful, makes me question my loyalties. But after I come out of it, when I am better rested and healed, and I'm able to more soberly process those thoughts and feelings, it's then that I discover that, yes, in some instances, I was correct in my judgment. But in other instances, I was simply creating scenarios that are unreal. And so, if we don't take care of ourselves, if we do not return to our base, do we have a focal point? Do we have a fixed point in time that we can retreat to or go to that will give us a sense of place and a sense of purpose where we can regather our strength, where we can rest? I think that's very important. In the old days, the ancients, they understood this. That's what the Tower of Babel was. It was a fixed point in the midst of a chaotic world. It's the same with columns, and it's actually the same with candles. All of these are symbols of a fixed point, of a focal point, something that we can focus our attention on, that hold our attention in the present tense. This is why people light candles when they pray. It focuses their thoughts so that they don't wander. They can focus on the candle and they can start to meditate on, well, Jesus is the light of the world, the light that no darkness can overcome. And in the midst of the darkness, that candlelight can drive away that darkness, of course. And then we can meditate on the symbolism of that, the higher truth of that, and recognize this is a good thing. So where do we gather our strength at? Where do we rally? Where is our standard? And I think that's important, whether it be the home or the church, some relationship, wherever it is that helps you kind of center yourself to stand in place, so to speak, and just stop and recognize I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I'm at the liminal edge. It's time to pull back and regroup. That's why it's called a midweek debrief. It's to sit down with you and say, here's where I'm at the midweek. Where are you at? And then to meditate on that with different texts, with the homilies, with the readings, just talking to you to remind myself and to remind you that we're not a perpetual motion machine. We can't just keep burning fuel and not expect for the engine to break down. And then what good are we to anybody, let alone ourselves? In modern American culture, the ethic of individuality, of hyper-consumerism, is all-dominating. This separation of the individual from the group has had deleterious, detrimental effects on each of us, because it has contributed significantly to isolation, loneliness, marginalization, which contributes exponentially to mental illness, depression, suicide, alcohol and drug addiction, and so on. It contributes to the degradation of relationships because we don't know how to be in relation to other people because we've been taught our whole lives, all that matters is me. But what happens then when we attempt to put someone else first, or family first, or the group first? Well, in many instances, we are consumed by it, and we don't know how to judge between what is good and beneficial and beautiful and true, and what is harmful and hurtful and detrimental. One of the things that I've been talking about in particular this week as an example, is that in church, the modern ethic of individualism has contributed to the church being atomized, so that everyone comes to church, or at least most people come to church on Sunday, and their thought process is, I'm here for me. I'm here to worship my God and to commune with my God in my way, and I agree to do it with these other people, but I'm just here to get something for myself. And when the sermon does not move them emotionally, or worship no longer feeds into their needs, or someone, the pastor or another person at church, tweaks their nose and leaves a bad taste in their mouth, as a consumer, as a shopper, they decide it's not worth paying for this product anymore. I'm going to go to a different store, which is a church, and I'm going to buy a different brand, a different product. And so pastors in particular, and you see this in the last 70 years or so of how churches have adopted a corporate ethic as to how they do outreach and evangelism, how they treat the congregation, they treat them as consumers. So the pastor is always asking for approval from the church before they do anything. Because if the customer's not happy, they're going to leave and take their money with them. And the ethic of the buyer is always right. The purchaser is always right, has found its way into the churches. And so God's word is not always right. The pastor's authority is not always right. The customer is always right. And because of fear, which has replaced faith and faithfulness, that fear has driven churches to adopt a corporate model and to then employ the techniques of marketing and advertising from the corporate world, which has led, of course, to a hasty retreat from churches by those who are serious about their faith, that they are seekers after truth and beauty and goodness. They're looking for comfort and consolation in the midst of the waters of tribulation in the world. But instead, they're sold free trade coffee. And they're sold sermon series on how to live a good Christian life. And they're told God loves them just the way they are. It's a sales pitch. That's all it is. Because when you read the Bible, it is wild stuff. It is weird. It is mythical stuff. There is so much mystery woven throughout the 66 books of the Bible that you cannot possibly understand. As I've said before, what you'll encounter in most churches today in America is the Bible is basic instructions before leaving earth, B-I-B-L-E, meaning the Bible is a manual. It's an owner's manual. Here we are back to consumerism. You've paid for the product. Here's the owner's manual. Read through the owner's manual so that if the product breaks down, you know how to fix it yourself, or at the very least, know how to call a repairman. But that's not what the original writers of the Bible intended at all. That's a very modern, very recent invention. The writers of the Bible, these ancients, understood that the Bible is an explanation of reality, and that second to that is an explanation of the meaning behind everything. That's the purpose of the Bible, to explain reality and the meaning behind everything. Morality is far, far downstream from that. Because, of course, if you are changed by reality, if you come to appreciate the hidden meaning behind things, you're going to change your behavior. It's going to happen. Because you want to participate in the greater reality. Once you are introduced to what is good and beautiful and true, you seek after more goodness and more beauty and more truth. And that is going to change your behavior, your habits, your choices, your entire cosmology and worldview. But instead, it's sold as an instruction manual. And then churches knock their heads against the wall, trying to retain members, trying to make sure they can pay the bills, and so on. We have strayed so far from the original intent of the Bible. and so far from the ancient church that it's come to the point where we don't really resemble the church at all anymore. We resemble a franchise. And I lament that, especially as an adult convert from atheism to Christianity. And that's why I have been pushing so hard the last 6 months or so for us to take up the torch and to keen our swords and prepare for battle. And whether we have to wage war against the institutional church, the corporate church, well, then that's what we have to do, because that's what the prophets were called to do. That's what John the Baptizer was called to do. That's what Jesus was doing when he railed against the religious authorities and called them whitewashed tombs and hypocrites. That is, he recognized, you've turned my Father's house into a den of thieves. That is, you've turned it into a gift shop. You're charging people. And you're charging them excessively for the things that are necessary for the worship of God in this temple. You're charging the Jewish people one price, and then you're choosing to charge the Gentiles a different price. You're putting your thumb on the scale. And that's not charitable. That's not compassionate. That's not the truth. And it's not good. And so in my own small way then, having this conversation in my little corner of the universe, I hope that I can speak apologetically to those of you who are seekers, and to say to you that there are places that still preach the truth. But you have to go looking for them, and you have to do it prayerfully. You have to pray, and you have to ask God to lead you to a church, some little local congregation in many instances, where the pastor faithfully does his duties without pomp and circumstance, without fanfare. And the congregation is simple. They just want church. They just want the truth. They want to participate in what is good and beautiful. They just want to be given Jesus and to be told, everything is not going to be all right if you're a Christian. You are going to suffer and struggle. You are going to struggle against reality. The world is going to attack you because Jesus said it will. Life is not easy. It is a struggle, and we suffer for it. Find a church prayerfully that will engage you and teach you and shepherd you, where you can form relationships that invigorate you and vitalize you, and you can have a relationship with your God that is equally invigorating, so that you can find life in the midst of your exhaustion. Otherwise, we're going to keep looking around us for solutions that, well, to be honest, to be blunt, I should say, I hate to be honest as a statement, as if everything I said before that is a lie. To be blunt, you're not going to find respite from friends or family or hobbies or your passions, because those are all temporary things. Those are all like the manna in the wilderness. They're things for today, but they're not going to last until tomorrow. And so what can you find, what can you consume that's going to satisfy you? Not just today, but always. Well, in Exodus, it's the bread that comes from heaven. It's the word of God. And so today then, I'll dive into the third part of my series, this mythic telling of creation through the resurrection of Jesus, to hopefully give you some inspiration, to edify you, and hopefully give you a moment's respite where you can simply sit there, lean back, and relax, and enjoy the dulcet tones of my voice. So let's get into it. This is then the reading for the third week in the season of Lent, from the book of the Judges, chapter 3, my translation. These are the peoples whom the Lord left so that he could teach Israel, and all those who did not know the battles with the Canaanites. and that afterwards their sons may learn to fight against enemies and to possess the knowledge of battle. He left 5 princes of the Philistines and all the Canaanites, and the people of Sidon and the Hivites who dwelt on Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon to the entrance of Hamath. He left them to test Israel, to know whether they would listen to the commandments of the Lord or not, which he commanded their fathers through the hand of Moses. So the sons of Israel lived in the midst of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters as wives, and gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. And the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and forgot their Lord God, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroths. And again, that is the book of Judges, chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. And now to the homily. To comprehend the meaning of Lent, we must look long at the coming of war. The people keened their swords. They made weapons of plowshares. The waters of the Jordan River piled up, and Israel entered Canaan. It was Joshua who led them, and the wild lion Caleb was with him. Like a storm they entered the land. Like a river in spring they flooded the country. Some towns burned. Others they spared. Swiftly they moved, for time was not on their side. Joshua divided the tribes. He issued orders, quickly, because quickly they sought out the opponents Yahweh proscribed. They were cherem, a ban, a thing set apart. That is the term for Joshua's wars. It is not a bloodthirsty word, though. An Israelite could give God a field. That field could be Kerem too. Many things could be set aside for Yahweh. In the wars, it meant giving something over completely. Who was under that ban? Anakim, Rephaim, Martu. These were giants. But Israel knew giants already. They had slain the witch kings Sihon and Og, and Og was the last of the Rephaim. His unclean spirit lingered long afterward. But in Canaan, there were Anakim. There were others from Bashan. There were many clans who knew the rituals and the methods of false incarnation that the flood had destroyed. Their towns were cherem, and they were burned until even the stones cracked. In many places, only ashes remained. Or should have. Israel did not succeed. Manasseh did not drive out the occupants of Beth Shean. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Zebulun did not drive out the occupants of Kitron. The list is long. Asher, Naphtali, Dan, these also abandoned the work. And so, many giants, and many priests, and many sibilant servants remained. They stayed in Canaan, like venomous serpents, slinking, slithering, poisoning partnerships, spreading rebellion, whispering to ghosts, to spirits who were their masters. So they also remained, in hiding at first, but in daylight afterward. to most of Israel, all seemed hopeful for a while. At Beth El, they set up the tabernacle. The angel of the Lord who had led them from Egypt was often seen, and visions were not rare. Joshua made war with the Shadu chieftains a long time. He crossed the Jordan River and took the land and split it up and served the Lord. And even so, before he died, he knew disaster was coming. When he set up an altar, he saw this. He renewed the covenant, and yet he could tell. "Choose today," he said, "who will you serve? As for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh." "We will also," the people said. Yet as they spoke, their eyes slipped sideways to their neighbors' wives and their neighbors' fields and their neighbors' altars that were far off. They desecrated all of these, but the people knew where they were. They had not forgotten the rituals there, the gluttonous feasts, the profusion of flesh. "You won't do it," Joshua said. His eyes, though pale with age, saw far. "And so this stone I set up will remember your broken covenant." He dismissed the people and died, and all his generation with him. Then there came a new generation that did not know the Lord. So their apostasy was swifter than ravens. Their rebellion was a crop that did not fail. The people defected. They sought out Canaanite superstition and learned again of the Baals, and Asherah also they enshrined. Old and vile these are, even among the rebel angels, and their worship is not for songs. It is sacrifice interwoven with intercourse and murder. It is bloodletting and spirit summoning and incantation. It is death itself and dust in the mouth. Then at the last, Yahweh relented. He gave the people what they chose. The angel of the Lord himself went up from Gilgal too, weeping, and Israel knew what that meant. Yahweh was leaving. The people did not want him, so he would go. When he spoke to them, it was like God beholding Abraham again. "I brought you up from Egypt," he said, "into the land I promised to your fathers. I said, I will never break my promise to you, and you will make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land." And truly, truly he had been faithful. The Lord has done all that he said. The people, well, the people had not. "What have you done?" he asked. "I will give you what you want. I will not drive out these people, nor their gods that you have chosen. They will be a noose round your neck. They will choke you and rule you and squeeze you out of your life's breath." "Did you not know this?" he lamented. Then Yahweh withdrew, and blood came afterward. A flood of blood, and Israel was oppressed by rebellious spirits and by the peoples that served them, and their sins weighed heavy upon them. So often they cried, and often did Yahweh send others to rescue them. These were strange women and men, some faithful, some less so. The judges. They were called the judges. The most famous of these was a debaucher, named for a demon, Shamash, whom we call Samson, who failed in the end. And there was no king in those days. Violence, was everywhere. Israel was vile and dark as the people of Tel El Hamam. Even Sodom and Gomorrah, who knew demonic rituals so well they tried to force themselves upon angels. Indeed, there was no godly king in those days. But the Lord had a solution. From ancient times it had been prepared. In Moab, far from the sea, two women crossed the stricken ground. Naomi from Bethlehem, and Ruth, a Moabite. Ruth was loyal, stout-hearted, as Moses was stout-hearted, and she found shelter in the virtue of an old man named Boaz. Boaz was descended from Perez, who was born to Judah by Tamar. Boaz was faithful, and his men wore swords in the field to protect the people. In that dark time, he married Ruth. With lawlessness on all sides, they were wed. And so it happened that Boaz, from Bethlehem, fathered Obed. And Obed, it is well known, fathered Jesse, of the line of Judah, who fathered David. This was a good king, for a time. But he was not the one to lead Yahweh's people back into Eden. David was a stone in the path upon which the paradise king trod. This king is the earth shaker. He is the cloud rider. He is the guardian of widows and orphans and a servant king who withholds nothing from his people. His face is young, yet old beyond the reckoning of this or any age, for he hails from eternity past. It is a beautiful face, full of humility and adoration and power. And he is crowned with purest golden light. He is the morning star, and his eyes burn. They blaze with immortal fires, and there is laughter there. Laughter and springtime and joy. Enough to set the whole cosmos to singing. No one can oppose him. No one ever could. The devil himself will bow before him, before he is fished out of the darkness and burned. Before him we too will kneel, with Adam and Eve and David and all his holy ones. And then the gates of Eden will open wide, and the universe will tremor and sigh, and the burden of the world will fall from our shoulders. At last we can rest. In the quiet dawn of eternity, his soft words, like the rush of many waters, yet as familiar as the voice of a friend, will lift our heads to behold. He has made all things new, and death can no longer be. Neither will crying, or pain, or mourning exist. Because as he says, it is finished. He is back, and this present age is gone forever. And that, again, is my homily based on the book of Joshua and Judges. And again, I hope that that was, and I pray that that was edifying for you, that it gave you comfort, that it gave you respite. I hope that it gives you peace and, God willing, understanding. Thank you again for listening to the podcast. Thank you for supporting the podcast in whatever way you choose to do that. I think that meditating on texts like this in particular, where we are seeking for deeper meaning, a more profound engagement and participation in reality is what so many people are sorely lacking for today, and yet desperately and naively hoping for. And I say naively because so many people I speak to don't know what they hope for, they just hope. And as Tolkien says, hope is not victory. But rather, it is in hope that we fight. And when we fight in hope, we will gain the victory. If not in this life, then in the life to come. So continue to fight the good fight. Continue to fight in hope. And understand that the light will win. And that those of us who are in the light, who participate with the light, through the light, will gain victory. And so keep on fighting. Keep on praying. Walk in the light as we are all in the light. And may God bless you. Talk to you again real soon, Space Monkeys. Peace.